Neither of them knew exactly what to expect. They had read nothing of the ledger except the boxed mottos and an occasional phrase or two, which, mostly due to Harold's convoluted style, meant little or nothing. What they saw at the ledger's beginning was therefore a complete shock. They read that first sentence, holding the ledger between them like children at a choir practice, and Fran said, "Oh," in a small, strangled voice, and stepped away, her hand pressed lightly to her mouth. "Fran, we have to take the book," Larry said. "Yes." "And show it to Stu. I don't know if Leo's right about them being on the dark man's side, but at the very least, Harold is dangerously disturbed. You can see that." "Yes," she said again. She felt faint, weak. So this was how the matter of the diaries ended. It was as if she had known, as if she had known it all from the moment she saw that big, smudged thumbprint. And she had to keep telling herself not to faint, not to faint. "Fran? Franny? Are you all right?" Larry's voice, from far away. The first sentence in Harold's ledger. "My great pleasure this delightful post-apocalypse summer will be to kill Mr. Stuart Dogcock Redman, and just maybe I will kill her, too." "Ralph? Ralph Brentner, you home?" "Hoo-hoo, anybody home?" She stood on the steps looking at the house. No motorcycles in the yard, only a couple of bikes parked around to one side. Ralph would have heard her, but there was the mute to think about, the deaf mute. You could holler until you were blue, and he wouldn't answer, and still he might be there. Shifting her shopping bag from one arm to the other, Nadine tried the door and found it unlocked. She stepped inside. She was in a small foyer. Four steps went up to the kitchen area, and a flight of them went down to the basement area where Harold said Andros had his apartment. Putting her most pleasant expression on her face, Nadine went downstairs, fixing her excuse in her mind if he should be there. "I came right in because I didn't think you'd know I was knocking. Some of us wanted to know if there's going to be a late shift wrapping those two motors that blew. Did Brad say anything to you?" There were only two rooms down there. One of them was a bedroom as simple as a monk's cell. The other was a study. There was a desk, a big chair, a wastebasket, a bookcase. The top of the desk was littered with scraps of paper, and she looked through them idly. Most of them made little sense to her. She guessed they were Nick's side of some conversation. Others seemed to be memos to himself, jottings, thoughts. A few of them reminded her of the boxes in Harold's ledger, what he called his guideposts to a better life, with a sarcastic smile. One read, "Talk to Glenn about trade. Do any of us know how trade starts? Scarcity of goods, isn't it? Or a modified corner on some market? Skills, that may be a key word. What if Brad Kitchener decides to sell instead of giving away? Or the dock? What would we pay with? Another, "Community protection is a two-way street." Another, "Every time we talk about the law, I spend the night having nightmares about Shoyo, watching them die, watching Childress throw his supper around the cell. The law, what do we do about the goddamned law? Capital punishment. Now there's a smiley thought. When Brad gets the power on, how long before someone asks him to rig an electric chair up?" She turned away from the scraps, reluctantly. It was fascinating to look through papers left by a man who could think wholly only by writing. One of her college profs had been fond of saying that the thought process can never be complete without articulation. But her purpose was already completed. Nick was not here. No one was here. To linger over long would be to press her luck unnecessarily. She went back upstairs. Harold had told her they would probably meet in the living room. It was a huge room, carpeted with a thick wine-colored shag rug, dominated by a freestanding fireplace that went up through the roof in a column of rock. The entire west wall was glass, giving on a magnificent view of the Flatirons. It made her feel as exposed as a bug on a wall. She knew that the outer surface of the glass was iodized, so that anyone outside would see only a mirror-like reflection. But the psychological feeling was still one of utter exposure. She wanted to finish quickly. On the southern side of the room, she found what she was looking for, a deep closet that Ralph hadn't cleaned out. Coats hung far back inside, and in the rear corner there was a tangle of boots and mittens and winter woolens about 3 feet deep. Working quickly, she took the groceries out of her shopping bag. They were camouflage, and there was only a single layer of them. Beneath the cans of tomato paste and sardines was the hush puppy's shoebox. "If I put it in a closet, will it still work?" she had asked. "Won't the extra wall muffle the blast?" "Nadine," Harold had responded, "if that device works, and I have no reason whatever to believe it won't, it will take the house and most of the surrounding hillside. Put it anywhere you think it will be unobserved until their meeting. A closet will be fine. The extra wall will blow out and become shrapnel. I trust your judgment, dear. It's going to be just like the old fairy tale about the tailor and the flies. 7 at a blow." Nadine pushed aside boots and scarves, made a hole, and slipped the shoebox into it. She covered it over again and then worked her way out of the closet. There. Done. For better or for worse. She left the house quickly, not looking back, trying to ignore the voice that wouldn't stay dead. The voice that was now telling her to go back in there and pull the wires that ran between the blasting caps and the walkie-talkie, telling her to give this up before it drove her mad. Because wasn't that what was really lying somewhere up ahead? Now maybe less than 2 weeks ahead? Wasn't madness the final logical conclusion? She slipped the bag of groceries into the Vespa's carrier and kicked the machine into life. And all the time she was driving away, that voice went on. "You're not going to leave that there, are you? You're not going to leave that bomb in there, are you? In a world where so many have died..." She leaned into a turn, barely able to see where she was going. Tears had begun to blur her eyes. "The one great sin is to take a human life. 7 lives here. No, more than that, because the committee was going to hear reports from the heads of several subcommittees." She stopped at the corner of Baseline and Broadway, thinking she would turn around and go back. She was shuddering all over. And later she would never be able to explain to Harold precisely what had happened. In truth, she never even tried. It was a foretaste of the horrors to come. She felt a blackness creeping over her vision. It came like a dark curtain, slowly drawn, flipping and flapping in a mild breeze. Every now and then the breeze would gust, the curtain would flap more vigorously, and she would see a bit of daylight under its hem, a little bit of this deserted intersection. But the curtain came over her vision in steady blackout drifts, and soon she was lost in it. She was blind. She was deaf. She was without the sense of touch. The thinking creature, the Nadine ego, drifted in a warm black cocoon like seawater, like amniotic fluid. And she felt him creep inside her. A shriek built up within her, but she had no mouth with which to scream. It was like nothing she had ever felt before. Later, similes occurred to describe it, and she rejected them one by one. You're swimming, and suddenly, in the midst of the warm water, you're treading water in a pocket of deep, numbing cold. You've been given Novocaine, and the dentist pulls a tooth. It comes out with a painless tug. You spit blood into the white enamel basin. There's a hole in you. You've been gouged. You can slip your tongue into the hole where part of you was living a second ago. You stare at your face in the mirror. You stare at it for a long time. 5 minutes, 10, 15. No fair blinking. You watch with an intellectual sort of horror as your face changes, like the face of Lon Chaney Jr. in a werewolf epic. You become a stranger to yourself, an olive-skinned doppelganger, a psychotic vampiro with pale skin and fish-slit eyes. It was really none of those things, but there was a taste trace of all of them. The dark man entered her, and he was cold. She was waiting for Harold around the corner from the bus station. When he saw her, his face froze and drained of color. "Nadine," he whispered. The lunch bucket dropped from his hand and clacked on the pavement. "Harold," she said, "they know. We've got to..." "Your hair, Nadine! Oh, my God, your hair! Listen to me!" He seemed to gain some of himself back. All right, what? They went up to your house and found your book. They took it away. Emotions at war on Harold's face. Anger, horror, shame. Little by little they drained away, and then, like some terrible corpse coming up from deep water, a frozen grin resurfaced on Harold's face. Who? I'm not sure. Fran Goldsmith was one of them, I'm sure of that. Maybe Bateman or Underwood, I don't know. But they'll come for you, Harold. How do you know? He grabbed her roughly by the shoulders, remembering that she had put the ledger back under the hearthstone. He shook her like a rag doll, but Nadine faced him without fear. She had been face to face with more terrible things than Harold Lauder on this long, long day. You bitch, how do you know? He told me. Harold's hands dropped away. Flag? A whisper. He told you what to do? He spoke to you? And it did that? Harold's grin was ghastly, the grin of the Reaper on horseback. What are you talking about? They were standing next to an appliance store. Taking her by the shoulders again, Harold turned her to face the glass. Nadine looked at her reflection for a long time. Her hair had gone white, entirely white. There was not a single black strand left. Come on, she said, we have to leave town. Now? After dark. We'll hide until then and pick up what camping gear we need on the way out. West? Not yet. Not until tomorrow night. Maybe I don't want to anymore, Harold whispered. He was still looking at her hair. She put his hand on it. Too late, Harold, she said. Chapter 48. Fran and Larry sat at the kitchen table of Stu and Fran's place, sipping coffee. Downstairs, Leo was stretching out on his guitar, one that Larry had helped him pick out at Earthly Sounds. It was a nice $600 Gibson with a hand-rubbed cherry finish. As an afterthought, he had gotten the boy a battery-powered phonograph and about a dozen folk blues albums. Now Lucy was with him, and a startlingly good imitation of Dave Van Ronk's Backwater Blues drifted up to them. Through the arch that gave on the living room, Fran and Larry could see Stu, sitting in his favorite easy chair, Harold's ledger open on his lap. He had been sitting that way since 4 p.m. It was now 9 and full dark. He had refused supper. As Franny watched him, he turned another page. Down below, Leo finished Backwater Blues, and there was a pause. He plays well, doesn't he? Fran said. Better than I do, Larry said. He sipped his coffee. From below, there suddenly came a familiar chop, a swift running down the frets to a not-quite-standard blues progression that made Larry's coffee cup pause. And then Leo's voice, low and insinuating, adding the vocal to the slow, driving beat. Hey, baby, I come down here tonight, and I didn't come to get in no fight. I just want you to say if you can. Tell me once, and I'll understand. Baby, can you dig your man? He's a righteous man. Baby, can you dig your man? Larry spilled his coffee. Whoops, Fran said, and got up to get a dishcloth. I'll do it, he said. Jiggled when I should have joggled, I guess. No, sit still. She got the dishcloth and wiped up the stain quickly. I remember that one. It was big just before the flu. He must have picked up the single downtown. Sure. What was that guy's name, the guy that did it? I can't remember, Larry said. Something familiar, she said, wringing the dishcloth out at the sink. It's funny how you get something like that on the tip of your tongue, isn't it? Yeah, Larry said. Stu closed the ledger with a soft snap, and Larry was relieved to see her look at him as he came into the kitchen. Her eyes went first to the gun on his hip. He had been wearing it since his election as marshal, and he made a lot of jokes about shooting himself in the foot. Fran didn't think the jokes were all that funny. Well? Larry asked. Stu's face was deeply troubled. He put the ledger on the table and sat down. Fran started to get him a cup of coffee, and he shook his head and put a hand on her forearm. No thanks, honey. He looked at Larry in an absent, distracted sort of way. I read it all, and now I've got a damn headache. Not used to reading so much. Last book I just sat down and read all the way through, like that, was this rabbit story, Watership Down. I got it for a nephew of mine and just started to read it. He trailed off for a moment, thinking. I read that one, Larry said. Great book. There was this one bunch of rabbits, Stu said, and they had it soft. They were big and well-fed, and they always lived in one place. There was something wrong there, but nobody knew what it was. Seemed like they didn't want to know. Only, see, there was this farmer, Larry said. He left the warren alone so he could take a rabbit for the stew pot whenever he wanted one. A little rabbit farm. Yeah, and there was this one rabbit, Silverweed, and he made up poems about the shining wire. The snare the farmer caught the rabbits in, I guess. The snare the farmer used to catch them and strangle them. Silverweed made up poems about that. He shook his head in slow, tired incredulity. And that's what Harold reminds me of. Silverweed the rabbit. Harold's ill, Fran said. Yeah. Stu lit a cigarette. And dangerous. What should we do? Arrest him? Stu tapped the ledger. He and the crosswoman are planning to do something so they'll be made to feel welcome when they go west. But this book doesn't say what. It mentions a lot of people he's not too crazy about, Larry said. Are we going to arrest him? Fran asked again. I just don't know. I want to talk it over with the rest of the committee first. What's on for tomorrow night, Larry? Well, the meeting's going to be in two halves, public business and then private business. Brad wants to talk about his turning off crew. Al Bundle wants to present a preliminary report from the law committee. Let's see, George Richardson on clinic hours at Dakota Ridge, and then Chad Norris. After that, they leave, and it's just us. If we get Al Bundle to stay after and fill him in on this Harold business, can we be sure he'll keep his lip zipped? I'm sure we can, Fran said. Stu said fretfully, I wish the judge was here. I cottoned to that man. But if it's got to be Al, it's got to be. I only see two choices anyway. We have to take the pair of them out of circulation. But I don't want to put them in jail, goddammit. What does that leave? Larry asked. It was Fran who answered. Exile. Larry turned to her. Stu was nodding slowly, looking at his cigarette. Just drive them out? Larry asked. Him and her both, Stu said. But will Flag take them like that? Franny asked. Stu looked up at her then. Fran, that ain't our problem. She nodded and thought, Oh, Harold, I didn't want it to come out like this. Never in a million years did I want it to come out this way. Any idea what they might be planning? Stu asked. Larry shrugged. I can think of some things. Such as? Maybe sabotage at the power plant. Maybe some sort of assassination attempt on you or Franny. Although he doesn't come right out and say it, I think he was hunting for Mother Abigail with you and Ralph that time in hopes of getting you alone and killing you. Stu said he had his chance. Maybe he chickened. Stop it, can't you? Fran asked dully. Please. Stu got up and went back into the living room. There was a CB in there hooked up to a die-hard battery. After some tinkering, he got Brad Kitchener. Brad, you dog, Stu Redman, listen. Can you round up some guys to stand watch at the power station tonight? Sure, Brad's voice came. But what in God's name for? Well, this is kind of delicate, Bradley. I heard one way and another that somebody might try to do some mischief up there. Brad's reply was blue with profanity. Stu nodded at the mic, smiling a little. I know how you feel. This is just for tonight and maybe tomorrow night, so far as I know. Then I guess things be ironed out. Brad told him he could muster 12 men without going two blocks. There's something Rich Moffat's up to? No, it ain't Rich. Listen, I'll be talking to you, okay? Fine, Stu, I'll have them on watch. Stu turned off the CB and walked back to the kitchen. People let you be just as secret as you want to be. It scares me, you know. The old bald-headed sociologist is right. We could set ourselves up like kings here if we wanted to. Fran put her hand over his. I want you to promise me something, both of you. Promise me we'll settle this once and for all at the meeting tomorrow night. I just want it to be over. Larry was nodding. Exile. Yeah, it never even crossed my mind, but it might be the best solution. Well, I'm going to collect Lucy and Leo and get home. I'll see you tomorrow, Stu said. Yeah. He went out. In the hour before dawn on September 2nd, Harold stood on the edge of Sunrise Amphitheater, looking down. The town was in a ditch of blackness. Nadine slept behind him in the small two-man tent they had picked up, along with a few other camping supplies, as they crept out of town. We'll come back, though, driving chariots. But in his secret heart, Harold doubted that. The darkness was upon him in more ways than one. The vile bastards had stolen everything from him. Franny, his self-respect, then his ledger, now his hope. He felt that he was going down. Behind him, Nadine moaned in her sleep. It was a scary sound. Harold thought she was as lost as he was, maybe worse. The sounds she made in her sleep were not the sounds of a person having happy dreams. But I can keep sane. I can do that. If I can go down to whatever's waiting for me with my mind intact, that will be something. Yes, something. He wondered if they had surrounded his little house, if they were waiting for him to come home so they could arrest him and throw him in the cooler. Welcome to hard times. Hawk caged, Wextry, Wextry, read all about it. Well, they would wait a long time. He was on his adventure. And he remembered all too clearly Nadine putting his hand on her white hair and saying, "Too late, Harold." How like a corpse's her eyes had been. "All right," Harold whispered. "We're going through with it." Around and above him, the dark September wind drummed through the trees. The Free Zone committee meeting was wrapped to order some 14 hours later in the living room of Ralph Brentner's house. Stu was sitting in an easy chair, tapping an end table with the rim of his beer can. "Okay, folks, we better get started here." Glenn sat with Larry on the curving lip of the freestanding fireplace, their backs to the modest fire Ralph had kindled there. Nick, Susan Stern, and Ralph himself sat on the couch, Nick with the inevitable pen and pad of notepaper. Brad Kitchener was standing just inside the doorway with a can of Coors in his hand, talking to Al Bundle, who was working a scotch and soda. George Richardson and Chad Norris were sitting by the large window wall, watching the sunset over the Flatirons. Franny was sitting with her back propped comfortably against the door of the closet where Nadine had planted the bomb. Stu glanced around at the 11 people spotted around the big combination living room-dining room area. "Okay. We've got a right smart of business, but first I'd like to thank Ralph for providing the roof over our heads and the booze and the crackers." He's really getting good at it, Franny thought. She tried to judge just how much Stu had changed since the day she and Harold had met him, and couldn't do it. You get too subjective about the behavior of the people you're close to, she decided. But she knew that when she first met him, Stu would have been stricken at the thought of having to chair a meeting of almost a dozen people. And he probably would have jumped straight up to heaven at the thought of chairing a mass Free Zone meeting of over 1,000 people. She was now watching a stew that never would have been without the plague. "It's released you, my darling," she thought. "I can cry for the others and still be so proud of you and love you so much." She shifted a little, propping her back more firmly against the closet door. "We'll have our guests speak first," Stu said, "and after that we'll have a short closed meeting. Any objections to that?" There were none. "Okay," Stu said, "I'll turn the floor over to Brad Kitchener, and you folks want to listen close because he's the guy that's going to put the rocks back in your bourbon in about 3 days. Brad walked to the center of the room. "We had two of the generators going yesterday, and as you know, one of them overloaded and blew its cookies, so to speak. That happened because when the plague hit, a lot of stuff got left on, and we didn't have the rest of the generators on to take the overload. We can take care of the overload danger by turning on the rest of the generators. Even three or four would have absorbed the load easily. But that isn't going to solve the fire danger. So we've got to get everything shut off that we can. Stove burners, electric blankets, all that stuff. In fact, I was thinking like this. The quickest way might be to go into every house where no one lives and just pull all the fuses or turn off the main breaker switches. See? Now, when we get ready to turn on, I think we ought to take some elementary fire precautions. I went to the liberty of checking out the fire station in East Boulder, and the fire snapped comfortably. It's going to be all right, Fran thought. Harold and Nadine have taken off without any prompting, and maybe that's best. It solves the problem, and Stu is safe from them. Poor Harold, I felt sorry for you, but in the end I felt more fear than pity. The pity is still there, and I'm afraid of what may happen to you, but I'm glad your house is empty and you and Nadine have gone. I'm glad you've left us in peace. Harold sat atop a graffiti-inlaid picnic table like something out of a lunatic's Zen handbook. His legs were crossed. His eyes were far, hazy, contemplative. He had gone to that cold and alien place where Nadine could not follow, and she was frightened. In his hands, he held the twin of the walkie-talkie in the shoebox. The mountains fell away in front of them in breathtaking ledges and pine-choked ravines. Miles to the east, maybe 10, maybe 40, the land smoothed into the American Midwest and marched away to the dim blue horizon. Night had already come over that part of the world. Behind them, the sun had just disappeared behind the mountains, leaving them outlined in gold that would flake and fade. When? Nadine asked. She was horribly keyed up, and she had to go to the bathroom badly. Pretty soon, Harold said. His grin had become a mellow smile. It was an expression she could not place right away, because she had never seen it on Harold's face before. It took her a few minutes to place it. Harold looked happy. The committee voted 7-0 to empower Brad to round up 20 men and women for his turning-off crew. Ralph Brentner had agreed to fill up 2 of the fire department's old tanker trucks at Boulder Reservoir and to have them at the power station when Brad turned on. Chad Norris was next. Speaking quietly, his hands stuffed into the pockets of his chino pants, he talked about the work the burial committee had done over the last 3 weeks. He told them they had buried an incredible 25,000 corpses, better than 8,000 a week, and that he believed they were now over the bulge. We've either been lucky or blessed, he said. This mass exodus, that's all I know to call it, has done most of our work for us. In another town Boulder's size, it would have taken a year to get it done. We're expecting to inter another 20,000 plague victims by the 1st of October, and we'll probably keep stumbling over individual victims for a long time after. But I wanted you to know that the job is getting done, and I don't think we have to worry too much about diseases breeding in the bodies of the unburied dead. Fran shifted her position so she could look out at the last of the day. The gold that had surrounded the peaks was already beginning to fade to a less spectacular lemon color. She felt a sudden wave of homesickness that was totally unexpected and almost sickening in its force. It was 8:05. If she didn't go in the bushes, she was going to wet her pants. She went around behind a stand of scrub, lowered herself a little, and let go. When she came back, Harold was sitting on the picnic table with the walkie-talkie clasped loosely in his hand. He had pulled up the antenna. Harold, she said, it's getting late. It's past 8:00. He glanced at her indifferently. They'll be there half the night, clapping each other on the back. When the time's right, I'll pull the plug. Don't you worry. When? Harold's smile widened emptily. Just as soon as it's dark. Fran stifled a yawn as Al Bundle stepped confidently up beside Stu. They were going to run late, and suddenly she wished she was back in the apartment, just the two of them. It wasn't just tiredness, not precisely that feeling of homesickness either. All of a sudden, she didn't want to be here in Ralph's house. There was no reason for the feeling, but it was strong. She wanted to get out. She wanted them all to get out. The law committee has had 4 meetings in the last week, Al was saying, and I'll keep this as brief as possible. Fran shifted uneasily, and Sue Stern winked at her. Fran didn't wink back. She was frightened, and frightened of her own baseless fear, if such a thing were possible. Where had this stifling, claustrophobic feeling come from? She knew that what you were supposed to do with baseless feelings was to ignore them, at least the old world. But what about Tom Collins' trances? What about Leo Rockway? Get out of here, the voice inside suddenly cried. Get them all out. But it was so crazy. She shifted again and decided to say nothing. Larry Underwood's hand waved. This tribunal, could members be excused for cause? Frowning a trifle at the interruption, Al said, I was just getting to that. The way it would work... Someone's coming, Fran said, getting to her feet. There was a pause. They could all hear motorcycle engines revving toward them up baseline, coming fast. Horns were beeping. And suddenly, for Franny, the panic overflowed. Listen, she said, all of you. Faces turning toward her, surprised, concerned. Franny, are you... Stu started toward her. She swallowed. It felt as if there was a heavy weight on her chest, stifling her. We have to get out of here. Right now. It was 8:25. The last of the light had gone out of the sky. It was time. Harold sat up a little straighter and held the walkie-talkie to his mouth. His thumb rested lightly on the send button. He would depress it and blow them all to hell by saying, What's that? Nadine's hand on his arm, distracting him, pointing. Far below, snaking up baseline, there was a daisy chain of lights. In the great silence, they could hear the faint roar of a great many motorcycle engines. Harold felt a thin thread of disquiet and threw it off. Leave me be, he said. This is it. Her hand fell from his shoulder. Her face was a white blur in the darkness. Harold pressed the send button. She never knew if it was the motorcycles or her own words that got them moving. But they didn't move fast enough. That would always be on her heart. They didn't move fast enough. Stu was first out the door, the snarl and echo of the motorcycles enormous. They came across the bridge that spanned the small dry wash below Ralph's house, headlights blazing. Instinctively, Stu's hand dropped to the butt of his gun. The screen door opened and he turned, thinking it would be Franny. It wasn't. It was Larry. What's up, Stu? Don't know, but we better get them out. Then the cycles were winding their way into the driveway, and Stu relaxed a little. He could see Dick Volman, the Geringer kid, Teddy Wyzak, others he recognized. Dick, Stu said, what the hell? Mother Abigail, Dick roared over the motors. More and more cycles filled the yard as the members of the committee crowded out of the house. It was a carnival of swinging headlights and merry-go-round shadows. What? Larry screamed. Behind him and Stu, Glenn, Ralph, and Chad Norris crowded out, forcing Larry and Stu to the foot of the steps. She's come back! Dick had to bellow to make himself heard over the cycles. Oh, she's in terrible shape! We need a doctor! Christ, we need a miracle! George Richardson pushed through them. The old woman? Where? Nick, come on, Fran cried, seizing his shoulder. Nick was standing in the middle of the living room, his face still, immobile. He couldn't talk, but suddenly he knew. He knew. It came from nowhere, from everywhere. There was something in the closet. He gave Franny a tremendous push. Nick! Go, he waved at her. She went. He turned to the closet, pulled open the door, and began to rip madly at the tangle of things inside, praying God that he wasn't too late. Get on, Doc, Dick shouted. Richardson got onto the passenger seat. Dick turned the cycle in a tight circle and began to weave his way back to the road. Franny was next to Stu then, her face pallid, her eyes huge. She clutched at him. Stu, Nick's still in there. Something... He pulled aside a handful of scarves and mittens and felt something, a shoebox. He grabbed it, and as he did, like malign necromancy, Harold Lauder's voice spoke from inside it. What about Nick? Stu shouted, grabbing her shoulders. We have to get him out. Stu, something's going to happen, something awful. Al Bundle shouted, What the hell's going on, Stuart? I don't know, Stu said. Stu, please, we have to get Nick out of there, Fran screamed. That was when the house blew up behind them. With the send button depressed, the background static disappeared and was replaced by a smooth, dark silence. Void, waiting for him to speak. Harold sat cross-legged on the picnic table, summoning himself up. Then he raised his arm, and at the end of the arm, one finger pointed out of his knotted fist. And at that moment, he was like Babe Ruth, old and almost washed up, pointing to the spot where he was going to hit the home run, pointing for all the hecklers and bad mouths in Yankee Stadium. Speaking firmly, but not loudly, into the walkie-talkie, he said, "This is Harold Emery Lauder speaking. I do this of my own free will." A blue-white spark greeted, "This is." A gout of flame shot up at Harold Emery Lauder speaking. A faint, flat bang, like a cherry bomb stuffed into a tin can, reached their ears at, "I do this." And by the time he had spoken the words, "of my own free will," and tossed the walkie-talkie away, its purpose served, a fire rose had bloomed at the base of Flagstaff Mountain. Nadine clutched at him, much as Franny had clutched at Stu only seconds ago. "We ought to be sure. We ought to be sure that it got them." Harold looked at her, then gestured at the blooming rose of destruction below them. "Do you think anything could have lived through that?"
I don't know. Oh, Harold, I'm..."
Nadine turned away, clutched her belly, and began to retch. It was a deep, constant, raw sound. Harold watched her with mild contempt. She turned back at last, panting, pale, wiping at her mouth with a Kleenex, scrubbing at her mouth.
"Now what?"
"Now I guess we go west," Harold said. "Unless you plan to go down there and sample the mood of the community." Nadine shuddered. Harold slid off the picnic table and winced at the pins and needles as his feet struck the ground. They had gone to sleep.
"Harold..."
She tried to touch him, and he jerked away. Without looking at her, he began to strike the tent.
"I thought we'd wait until tomorrow," she began timidly.
"Sure," he jeered at her. "So 20 or 30 of them can decide to fan out on their bikes and catch us. Did you ever see what they did to Mussolini?" She winced. Harold was rolling the tent up and cinching the ground cords tight. "And we don't touch each other. That's over. It got Flag what he wanted. We wasted their free zone committee. They're washed up. They may get the power on, but as a functioning group, they're washed up. He'll give me a woman who makes you look like a potato sack, Nadine. And you, you get him. Happy days, right? Only if I was wearing your shoes, I would be shaking in them plenty."
"Harold, please."
She was sick, crying. The irrevocable fact of murder was in her heart forever. "Get used to it," Harold said brutally. He flung the tent on the back of a cycle and began to tie it down. "It's over for them down there, and it's over for us. And it's over for everybody that died in the plague. God went off on a celestial fishing trip, and he's going to be gone a long time. It's totally dark. The dark man's in the driver's seat now. Him. So get used to it." She made a squeaking, moaning noise in her throat. "Help me get this shit packed up. I want to do 100 miles before sunup." After a moment, she turned her back on the destruction below, destruction that seemed almost inconsequential from this height, and helped him pack the rest of the camping gear in his saddlebags and her wire carrier. 15 minutes later, they had left the fire rose behind and were drifting through the cool and windy dark, headed west. For Fran Goldsmith, that day's ending was painless and simple. She felt a warm push of air at her back, and suddenly she was flying through the night. She had been knocked out of her sandals. "What fuck," she thought. She landed on her shoulder, landed hard, but there was still no pain. She was in the ravine that ran north to south at the foot of Ralph's backyard. A chair landed in front of her, neatly, on its legs.
"What fuck?"
Something landed on the seat of the chair and rolled off, something that was dripping. With faint and clinical horror, she saw that it was an arm.
"Stu? Stu, what's happening?"
A steady, grinding roar of sound engulfed her,
and stuff began to rain down everywhere. Rocks, hunks of wood, bricks, a glass block spiderwebbed with cracks. Hadn't the bookcase in Ralph's living room been made of those blocks? A motorcycle helmet with a horrible, lethal hole punched through the back of it. She could see everything clearly, much too clearly. It had been dark only a few seconds ago. Oh, Stu, my God, where are you? What's happening? Nick? Larry? People were screaming. That grinding roar went on and on. It was now brighter than noontime. Every pebble cast a shadow. Stuff still raining down all around her. A board with a 6-inch spike protruding from it came down in front of her nose. The baby. And on the heels of that, another thought came, a reprise of her premonition. Harold did this. Harold did this. Harold... Something struck her on the head, the neck, and back. A huge thing that landed on her like a padded coffin. Oh, my God, oh, my baby! Then darkness sucked her down to a nowhere place where not even the dark man could follow.